Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It is time for our weekly Reporters Roundtable. Joining me in the studio is Mark Niket of Bloomberg News. Mark, welcome back.
Thanks. Good morning.
And Kathy Kandiski of the Columbus Dispatch. Kathy, welcome back.
I'm glad to be here.
And Chrissy Thompson of the Cincinnati Inquirer. Chrissy, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you.
All right. So Governor John Kasich is expected to unveil the sum and substance of a proposed income tax cut for working Ohioans tomorrow, and the likely target of the complementary tax hike, because there has to be some money to replace the tax cut, right, is a dollar increase for a pack of cigarettes. That's what has been bandied about. And it could disproportionately affect the poor among us. What's the problem? What are we expecting the governor to say, Chrissy Thompson?
Well, the governor wants to get the top income tax bracket down under 5%. And to do that, they have to do, I believe, at least a 6 or 7% income tax cut. And it would happen. It would apply to every bracket. But that will be controversial because the most money that you would get back, just because the wealthiest bracket pays the most in taxes, will go to the wealthiest Ohioans. So in order to pay for that, the governor has to come up with some areas to increase taxes. And he's said that he wants to cut back on smoking in Ohio. And so in his mind, the way to do that is to make cigarettes more expensive. Sometimes it's difficult, I think, to argue in favor of keeping cigarettes affordable. But we do have to remember that, some will say that people who are addicted to cigarettes this is something that they don't want to be addicted to often. This is something that they're struggling with. These are things that they use to cope. And this just isn't just an easy problem that one can just say, oh, well, I can no longer afford cigarettes, so I'm done smoking.
Why does it disproportionately affect lower income people, Mark?
Well, I think the thought is the people who smoke tend to be more poor. And the whole idea is it'd be a higher percentage of their income, essentially, to buy a cigarette as opposed to somebody who's wealthy and, it's nothing to put down. I don't even know what a pack of cigarette costs these days.
Like $5 or $6? I don't know.
I have
it's something
no idea.
Shocking.
But it's kind of like the sales tax. The idea it's sort of regressive where it takes a higher percentage of your income. It's a small amount, but relatively speaking, it's a higher percentage of your income than if you're more wealthy.
So the governor wants people to quit smoking, though.
Well, the governor just announced recently, I think he was going to add some more money into Ohio's smoking cessation programs, mm-hmm. which were pretty much gutted. During the recession, they took that money that they were supposed to be spending on those programs and they used it to shore up the budget. So the folks that support those programs have been pushing for a dollar increase in the cigarette tax.
To be spent on, however.
Yes,
that's
exactly.
Right. That's how you sell that, right? Is say, oh, yes. Well, we're going to put it into smoking cessation programs. But if he's also going to put it into an income tax cut that progressives will say, disproportionately benefits the wealthy, that that isn't the exchange that they would be looking for.
And there's no question that the folks wanted that money for their anti-smoking programs. The amount the governor put into it, they feel is far short of what they actually need to make a dent. But that's something they support and they have long sought. I don't recall exactly, but it's been several years since Ohio's had an increase on the cigarette tax. So, the government has a good argument that it's overdue.
I think the state ranks 29th in the nation.
I think that's right.
I believe in the cost of a pack of cigarettes. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I have a State House Reporters Roundtable today. If you have a question or comment, something you want to know about state government or politics, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So what else? He's supposed to be unveiling that tomorrow. What else is he going to be unveiling? Is it just that?
Well, it'll be his mid-year budget review.
Okay.
They call it the MBR. So there'll be all the policy proposals, on taxes, education, poverty, a lot of the initiatives he talked about in his State of the State address. But I think the big fight's going to be on the tax side, and this whole idea he wants to get the income tax down. But as we talked about, that involves raising other taxes. So there'll be some fight on the cigarette tax, but I think a bigger fight on the severance tax. The governor's Absolutely. Going to include, I'm told, as part of this package, a higher tax for drilling.
Shale.
Right, for natural gas and oil.
Right.
This would be essentially, because you're taking minerals out of the ground, you have to pay some tax for it. And the legislature has a bill moving now with a severance tax increase. I don't think it's been changed since the 70s. And the governor has said it's not high enough. So, you know, there'll be something in this that will talk about an increase in the severance tax as well. And there'll be a fight over, one, what's that amount? And two, is that amount, should that go to an income tax cut, or should that go to the counties that are heavily impacted by the drilling to offset some of the costs they're seeing?
And a difference, too, with that fight is it's largely between Republicans. I mean, Democrats support the severance tax, but this is a lot of Republicans don't support a severance tax increase, right?
Any kind of tax increase. And that's
right.
Going to be the fight within the Republican caucus. Okay, we love the income tax cut, right? But, you know, how much can we support an increase in
offsetting
taxes?
They want to make cuts in spending. They
exactly.
don't want to.
They'll support probably some increase, but the question is how much. And, you know, again, as you talk about, what do you use the proceeds for?
What about the cigarette tax, possible cigarette tax increase? Is that something that Republicans generally will support?
You know, it just depends in some ways on how much the tobacco lobby fights back.
Okay.
That's a business, right? And that's something that kind of gets sticky and you know, progressives would say it's just a terrible fight. But that is something that that Republicans can be caught in the middle of because, they're supposed to be pro-industry. So
that's a strong lobby, as Chrissy alluded to. And we'd be foolish not to expect there will be a strong fight against it, and it'll be a tough dilemma for many of the lawmakers. I expect that none of these will be easy.
And the other thing that we will probably see a small increase in is the commercial activity tax, and that's something that businesses have to pay. So I talked to my local chamber, the Cincinnati USA Chamber, which is, I think they're always telling me, I think it's the fifth largest chamber of commerce in the country. So it's a huge, huge group of businesses. And, yes, we are in favor of an income tax cut. We are in favor of an income tax cut. And because they're from Southwest Ohio, sure, let's pay for it with a severance tax. And then you bring up the CAT tax, right? Or CAT, I guess T stands for tax.
Commercial activities.
That's right. And they say, well, we would need to see the proposal. They won't make a comment. You know what I mean? And so that's a sticky situation for, especially for small businesses where, you know.
Well, what does the commercial activities tax do?
Well, there'll be a fight over this as well because the CAT was implemented to replace the tangible personal property tax. This is when they did the whole tax reform in 2005.
Okay.
And the idea was, you know, we had this tangible personal property tax that was a tax on inventory. So we were taxing businesses for the inventory they had. And the thought was that was punitive or that, you know, discourage companies from investing. So they scrapped that tax and replaced it with this CAT, which is a tax on the sales, essentially, or the business activity you have in the state. And the fight's going to be the way this was sold was it was going to be very broad. A lot of people, almost everybody, will pay it at a certain amount, but the rate would be low. And the whole idea was it would be, you know, not as painful for individual businesses as this, you know, tangible personal property tax was. So if we're talking about raising the rate of the CAT, there'll be a fight about, well, you know, doesn't this defeat the purpose of putting the CAT in place in the first place?
Now, not to confuse commercial activities tax with, say, what we pay at the cash register. That's
right,
very
that's
different.
Sales tax. This is business
between
tax.
Businesses.
Right. It's
right.
A business
activity
tax.
Between businesses.
It's on revenue, right? So
right.
that's however much money you take in sales, then you get taxed on it.
Right. We'll find out tomorrow when the governor unveils. We all wait with bated breath.
You know, I might mention there's another tax that some Republicans are concerned about, and that's the increase in the tax on what the employers pay for unemployment. And that's because Ohio hasn't paid back its federal loan for paying unemployment. And you're hearing more and more some conservatives in the Republican Party, I guess, obvious, that they want to get that paid off because it triggers an automatic increase on employers every January. And I think we've had two or three so far. They're only about 1/3%, something like that. They're pretty small, but after you start adding them year after year, you know, it adds up, and there's some concern about that as well. I don't know if there'll be anything in the governor's proposal that'll try and pay that debt down to eliminate it, but we still owe quite a bit on that.
And that is expected to come from employers.
employers pay into the unemployment system. They pay a tax so that when workers are out of work, they, you know, that's what they collect. So yeah, Ohio had to borrow during the recession to keep its fund, keep, you know, benefits paying, and now employers are having to pay a higher tax to pay off that debt.
Sean in Columbus, you had something to say about the commercial activities tax?
Yeah, it was a bad idea in 2005 and continues to be a terrible idea, especially for small business, because many times small business, and especially the kind of businesses that we want, the high-tech businesses, they operate at a loss for a period of time, and to take anything, one bit of percentage out of the overall revenue is a giant hit, and it discourages people from doing that type of stuff here. I mean, it directly discourages people from doing those types of things because it is a huge hit because you're not making any profit for a while, and that's just the nature of small business development.
What about the tax that it was supposed to kind of replace back in 2005, the one on
property? Yeah, well, that's a total misnomer because people buy inventory and people turn inventory so much faster than they did back in that time that they're not sitting on a lot of inventory these days. And it doesn't take a lot of inventory to start a business. It does take capital and it does take a motion toward profit.
But for small businesses, but big businesses, the inventory tax was probably very advantageous.
Maybe, but not really, because if you think of someplace like Honda, they have just-in-time inventory. So their inventory is so floating and so fluid that what they have at any given moment is not like it was back in the day where things were just, you know, back in the 90s or 80s or before, where warehouses were just packed full of millions or if not tens of millions of dollars worth of inventory. That's really not happening as much as it was back a long time ago. And small businesses never have that type of inventory. They have, you know, anywhere from $100,000 to $1 million worth of inventory any given time. And that's, you know, not pleasant to be taxed on that either, but to be taxed on your overall revenue when you may have zero profit because you're developing is just clearly an idea that came out of people that have no small business experience.
Mm-hmm. Well, it came out of the Ohio General Assembly back in 2005. And Sean, thank you for your call.
Sure.
The caller raises a good point because this was a big point of discussion when they implemented the tax, because I think the idea was it would particularly help manufacturers who would tend to have higher inventory levels and
were being penalized. But the just-in-time approach has taken hold.
Right. And he raised a good point, and this was a big pushback, that if you are a business with a low margin, small business, retailers, a lot of retailers, they feel like it's punitive to them because, you know, they get taxed on their revenue, but their profits are small. Their margins, at least, are small.
Mm-hmm. We are going to return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We have our weekly reporters roundtable in the studio today. If you have a question or comment about state government politics, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Ohio Secretary of State John Husted last week issued a decision that says Libertarians Charlie Earl and his running mate Sherry Clark are not eligible for nomination during the May 6th primary election by Libertarian Party for the offices of governor and lieutenant governor, and also the fellow that was running was going to run for attorney general from the Libertarian Party, also not eligible. What happened, Kathy Kandisky?
Actually, I'm going to defer to one of the reporters that
Okay. Chrissy Thompson.
Yeah, I covered this. So what happened basically was the signature gatherers that the Libertarian Party paid to help gather signatures for or that helped the Libertarian Party, that the funding came from other places. In some cases, they don't have a whole lot of money in that party. But to help gather signatures to get Charlie Earl and Steve Linneberry on the ballot, they needed 500 signatures. And there was a lot of debate over...
Just 500 signatures.
Just 500 signatures because they're a third-party candidate. The major party candidates need 1,000.
Right.
So there was quite a bit of debate. There was a hearing early last week, and there was quite a bit of debate over Democrats' involvement or alleged involvement in the signature gathering. So things like in 2012, the Democratic Party gave almost $1 million to a group that this year then... helped fund some of the signature gathering. Things like the Democrats, Chris Redfern, who's chair of the Democratic Party, met with Kevin Nedler, who's the chair of the Libertarian Party, when it looked like Charlie Earle wasn't going to get enough signatures to get on the ballot. It wasn't going to get those 500 signatures. So
there's nothing wrong with the Democrats doing this, is there?
Well, the question then became is whether any of that help directly paid for the signature gathering because or whether the members of the signature gatherers were not libertarians, because you have to, by law, be a member of the party when you're gathering these signatures. So they had paid a couple of contractors to gather signatures, and therefore the question was, well, are these people really Democrats? Are they not libertarians? So that was one of the questions. However, the recommender, it's a former federal elections commissioner, who kind of heard the hearing and then made a recommendation to John Husted, said, no, there's not anything really conclusive to say these people were Democrats. So we're just going to say they could be libertarians, move on. So what he actually ruled was that kind of a technicality was not followed by the signature gatherers. They did not list who was paying them on the form when they were gathering the signatures. And that is a requirement of law. And he ruled that the signatures that those people gathered were invalid, and therefore the candidates did not have enough signatures to qualify for the ballot. That was Friday that he issued that ruling, and John Husted affirmed it. So
by cook or by hook or by crook, one way or the other,
that's
Charlie...
That's kind of a long story, right?
No, well, Charlie Earle is off the ballot. Do they have any recourse at this point?
Well, the talk was they would file a federal lawsuit to challenge being kicked off the ballot, I think under First Amendment rights, and we'll see what happens there. I guess he could also run as a write-in, but, you know, the whole idea was, you know, they wanted to get it through the primary to be nominated to appear on the general election ballot.
That's right.
You called it a technicality. Why call it a technicality if it's part of the rules?
Yeah, and I so I would say some people would say it's a technicality, and some people would say it's the law, right? Mm-hmm. So that's you know, the one of the signature gatherers who made this mistake said he's never filled out the form correctly and all the signatures that he's gathered, and that's what he does for a living. So I don't know if that's true or not. That's what he says. And there was quite a bit of debate in the recommenders. You know, they kind of issue almost a ruling, like a court ruling, right, and kind of discuss case law and things like that. And there was quite a bit of debate in there about, well, you know, we could look at it this way, we could look at it this way, but he is charged with making a decision on what he thinks the law says, and that's ultimately what he decided to do. So...
it's subjective, just like all this stuff.
Well, and this is part of a game that, you know, happens all the way down at the county level, too. And the whole idea is if you can challenge the signatures or challenge the petition and keep somebody off the ballot, you know, that's the way, you know, to go.
You know, this benefits, obviously, this benefits the Republicans to have him on. John Husted's a Republican.
That's right.
So, you know, it raises questions about motives and such. But it helps the Republicans not to have him on the ballot, so some will view it like that. Just like it helps the Democrats to have him on the ballot.
That's right.
And that may explain why the Democrats are being so helpful to this conservative candidate.
That's right. So, yeah, that's a very important point, is that, you know, the Libertarians are kind of caught in the middle here, and they're willing to be, you know, in some ways. The thought is that Charlie Earle might take some votes away from John Kasich for his support of Medicaid expansion or things like that. You know, it remains to be seen whether conservative Tea Parties will really vote for a candidate who supports abortion and legalization of marijuana and gay marriage. You know, that it just Tea Partiers are, they are from different groups, right? So some of them would be fine with that. Some of them won't be. So, you know, there was even a discussion a couple weeks ago with Matt Borges, who's chairman of the Ohio Republican Party, where he said We actually filed the complaint, and that's not legal. And someone said, are you sure? And he said, no. Oh, that's right. We did not file the complaint.
Why isn't it legal for them to file the complaint?
Only libertarians can file
this is, yeah, this is a party nomination process. So
gotcha.
That's right.
You have to be part of the party.
And he said, oh, yes, that's right. And I talked to a spokesman last week, and he said, we looked at it very closely because we were concerned, but we did not file anything, you know, that was only libertarians. So, read into that what you will, right? So, but there is a huge political process going on here. The Democrats want the guy on the ballot so that John Kasich doesn't get as many votes.
This all goes back to, you know, the 2010 election where John Kasich won by only 2 percentage points, 87,000
votes. Didn't even get a majority, right?
So the thought is, you know, it could matter if the election is that close again.
Right. There's been debate also over whether the Virginia governor's race, whether the Libertarian there, he drew, I think, 6.5%, whether that helped the Democrat win. But, you know, there's a lot of debate as to whether that really, those people really would have even showed up to vote if he weren't on the ballot.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. John in Marysville, you have a question. Welcome to the show, John.
Thank you, Ann. I'm a candidate for the 86th District. I'm a Democrat. And when I did my petition, petition drive to get me on the ballot, I needed at least 50 signatures, either by Democrats or independents. I'm wondering if that same bar was held to the Libertarian candidate.
That's right. That is the standard, right? So you have to either be a registered Libertarian or not registered as
to
anything.
Anything. That's the way it is in Ohio. If you're an independent, that means you're not registered to anything.
Right. And so you could. You could sign, and in fact, one of the people who brought the complaint, it has to be a voter who signed the petition and then said, well, hey, I didn't know such and such, right? So was not one of them was not a Libertarian. It was just an independent voter. So.
Okay. John, thanks a lot for that call. 614-292-8513 is the number to call if you have a question or comment for us. Our State House reporter roundtable today with Mark Niket of Bloomberg News, Kathy Kandisky of the Columbus Dispatch, and Chrissy Thompson of the Cincinnati Inquirer. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. Now, let's turn to voting rights in general. Republicans are trying to give Democrats their comeuppance lately. Democrats were complaining because of the GOP bills that passed and the governor signed recently that eliminates Golden Week when you can both register and vote during the early voting period. The Republicans are calling them hypocrites for supporting a measure some years ago that would have reduced the number of early voting days in much the same way as that new law crafted by the Republicans. But there are differences. The Republican bill, big differences. The Republican bill was signed into law, and Democrats say that the bill from 4 years ago included other provisions to soften the blow of the lost voting days. What do we have here right now, Mark Niket?
Well, part of it's just trying to score political points because Jim Siegel from the Dispatch had a story about this today where apparently on the floor or in debate about the bills, the Republicans were pointing out, hey, you Democrats, you voted for getting rid of Golden Week. And in fact, you know, you wanted to restrict it more than this bill does. But really what happened was, you know, back in 2005, this is after the 2004 election, Jennifer Bruner, who was Secretary of State at the time, convened sort of this high-level review of the election process and came out with a bunch of recommendations that ended up into a bill, including one of them was getting rid of Golden Week so you didn't have this overlap between when you could register and when you could start voting, but a whole series of other things, too, that related to, you know, adding more weekend voting, more early voting centers. So, you know, the pushback from the Democrats now is, okay, well, we might have, you know, voted to, you know, reduce Golden Week, we expanded voting access in the big picture with other provisions. So it's not comparable what, you know, is happening now versus what was done back in 2005.
It seems like kind of in the weeds for most people. And I did see Jim's Siegel story today in the Dispatch. Why the interest in this kind of background noise?
Well, it's all about scoring political points because the bigger picture is the Democrats want to say that it's voter suppression if you eliminate opportunities to vote, even restricting the amount of days you can do early absentee voting. And the Republicans want to say, no, that's not voter suppression because you have plenty of opportunity to vote. And hey, look, you know, Democrats even voted, once upon a time to reduce the amount of voting time.
Do you think ultimately what's happened in with regarding access to voting with these new laws are going to have any residual effect on Republicans going forward? Is anyone going to remember? Is it going to affect?
I think that it might. We have to remember the communities that these new laws affect disproportionately are usually minority urban communities.
Democrat voters.
That's right. And I think this may not be the best example, but something that comes to mind right away is, do you remember back during the whole Will Todd Portun run?
Or lack thereof.
That's right. Yeah. There was an awful lot of discussion led by him and echoed by some people. Late last year and through the fall and into the winter of last year, saying, is Ed Fitzgerald a candidate that minority voters can support? Mm-hmm. That has largely been we've moved past that in a lot of ways. Most of the leading African-American Democrats have come out in support of him. But mm-hmm. it took longer than expected. And, so if something like that were to happen in the future, maybe if someone was on the fence about John Kasich or about the Republicans, perhaps remembering this would galvanize them to come out and vote or to vote for the Democrat. Republican voters, though, some of them like these provisions, the fairness, to the county level, which is what the Republicans will argue, right? This needs
uniformity.
To be fair. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of, small town, rural Republican voters who feel like sometimes that their vote doesn't count as much, right? And they want everybody to be able to do the same thing. So that is something that matters to Republicans in some ways. They're constituents like this.
Mm-hmm. At a very base political level, this is about getting your voters to the polls and getting your folks to vote. Because the thought is the more opportunities you have for voting, the more Democrats you can get to the polls. Particularly, what they really care about is the Sunday before the election and other Sunday opportunities, but particularly that Sunday, because churches, particularly in the African American community, have, they call it souls to the polls, mm-hmm. where go to church and then go right to the polls to vote. And the idea is that this would get more people to vote who otherwise wouldn't, particularly on the Democratic side. And very generalized, cliche way, the thought is, Republican voters are more committed voters in a sense that, particularly the really strong party voters will get to the polls even just on election day.
No matter what.
Yep. But that, maybe Democrats need a little more push sometimes, or particularly in communities where, let's face it, it's a little more difficult for them. So the thought is the more opportunities you have for voting, the better it is for Democrats. And, conversely, the Republicans would want to limit those opportunities. Ultimately, I don't know what impact it really does have. I mean, my own sense is these fights are about votes on the margin. It might make a difference, again, in a really close election, but does it necessarily sway a lot of elections? I'm not so sure.
I don't think it sways a lot of voters, in their decision-making.
Terms of who votes and how many votes are cast.
Yeah. Right.
It should be said, the souls of the polls is a grand cultural tradition that started with, to some extent, the fear of voting alone and the dangers of going to the polls. And it's something that's been done for a long time one way or another. It's quite a celebration, I understand. So
There's no effort to take that, to reduce that, I've heard of anyway. There's no effort to do that. But anytime you take away, you're going to run into some resistance. It's hard. But ultimately, I just don't think it affects the outcome of the race
per se, in terms
of who people vote for.
Right. Chrissy, you wrote that Ohio doesn't appear likely to change its marijuana laws this year.
That's right.
Especially medical marijuana. That's the only thing really being considered. What are the hurdles at this point?
Threefold. One is, they got to get 385,000 signatures by July 2nd. They've got 50,000. They think that they could raise them if they get a couple million dollars by the end of the month. But right now they only have $4,500 on hand, and they say they've got another $50,000 or so promised. But that's not anywhere close to what you would need to pay a signature gathering firm, as we were discussing earlier, right? So that's one hurdle. Well, the money and the number of signatures are, I guess, two hurdles. They haven't really gotten any national groups to sit down with them.
Which you kind of need at this point.
You need that for this money, right? I mean, where are you going to get this kind of money in Ohio at the last minute? So they're not really Ohio is not a national focus for this year.
And is it not a national focus because they don't think it can pass here yet? Is that?
Well, we have 8-1 support among voters. So I would think if it gets on the ballot, it probably would pass. Even without very much of a robust campaign, because you can't imagine that a negative campaign against medical marijuana would be able to take down 30-40 percentage points of voters. I mean, that's insane. But the last reason is that, probably the quickest way to get this passed would be through the legislature.
That's not happening.
But Republicans are certainly not going to support this at all. And Democrats aren't even supporting it. There is no one willing to stick out their neck except for three people. There are three Democrats in the entire General Assembly who have signed on to these bills.
Bob Hagan and who
Bob
else?
Bob Hagan, Bob Hagan, who else?
Foley. Remind me of his first name. Representative Foley and then Representative Ramos signed on to the medical marijuana one. The other two have signed on to regular legalization also of marijuana. But that's like, it's just not going to happen with that little level of support,
Right, with that little level of support in the legislature and yet such vast support outside among their constituents.
Right, but Chrissy's right. And I think where this is passed in other states, particularly on legalizing marijuana, it's passed in Colorado and Washington State now. And, the elected officials wanted nothing to do with it. It passed because it went to the ballot and people got a chance to vote on it. And the voters approved it.
Yeah.
That's going to be preferred. I mean, this is the kind of thing that maybe a majority of voters support, but those that don't really oppose it.
And they tend to be.
And so that carries what I would call high negatives.
Okay.
So it's a risky vote for a legislator. And the precedent already, as you mentioned, in other states is to throw it on the ballot. So let the voters do this one. I mean, I'm sure this is the same, gay marriage we'll see handled the exact same way. Mm-hmm. Lawmakers just assume not touch these issues for obvious reasons.
I would just bring up two other things that I think are important to remember. One is that we have this talk to your government tool at the Enquirer's website, and it allows people to send emails to the governor or someone like that. Mm-hmm. It notifies them, the Enquirer will receive this also just for our, they can check, like, can you publish this or can you not, type of a thing. Well, reading those, we got, I think, 29 responses, which is pretty high for something like that. They were all in favor of legalizing medical marijuana, and most of them were heartbreaking. Things like, my daughter has had seizures since she was 2. She's 13 now. She will never have a friend. She will never walk down the aisle. She will, just because of these constant seizures. Please, please let us try this, Or this, another family. My son is has autism, and he's very violent, and we've gone through 4 car windshields, 3 computers, blah, blah, blah. Please, please let us try this. These medicines they want to put him on are dangerous and they don't help. And we, things like that. So that it's just it's heartbreaking to hear the situations that some of these families are in where they're desperate to try something that has been successful in other states. Yeah. And the other thing to bring up is so we ask, why, if Ohio has this huge amount of support, more than our neighbors, right? Kentucky and Indiana, there's a majority of support, but nothing like what we have here. So why are we not on the national, list? Right.
Yeah,
and I
question.
Think one reason might be I didn't I was doing more of kind of a my story didn't quite get into this angle. But I think one reason might be that the language for the ballot amendment or the ballot initiative that would have this constitutional amendment, it doesn't really borrow from the national language.
OK.
And I am just wondering if some of the national groups aren't willing to pay, you know, they want to pay for their own language.
Like the gay marriage issue.
That's right.
All right, we'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guests, Chrissy Thompson from the Cincinnati Enquirer, Kathy Kandisky from the Columbus Dispatch, and Mark Niquette from Bloomberg News. We're talking about state government and politics. Have a question or comment? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We started to get into the governor's mid-biennium budget review unveiling MBR. Tomorrow.
MBBBBB.
Blah, 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 blah. This is big stuff, Ann.
It is big stuff. It didn't used to be. I mean, it used to just be a correction bill every couple years, but now it's a big, hairy deal.
Big policy.
Things change, and there's supposed to be some policy making regarding vocational education and that sort of thing.
On the education front, the governor's been talking quite a bit about trying to get students matched with careers and jobs that are available right now in Ohio that maybe companies are having some trouble filling. And so he's pushing more students to get involved in vocational and career tech education. And we expect to hear more on that in the MBR, and also mentoring, where his whole idea, and I'm not really sure how it will work exactly, but his whole idea is to start kind of grooming students earlier, exposing students earlier, maybe in 7th and 8th grade middle school kids, to possible career choices and exposure to what those jobs are like, things that the student may not have thought about. You know, we're not talking about firefighters or NHL players and such, but jobs, you know, like in the computer industry or engineering or those types of things. So the governor would like to see some vocational education opportunities earlier for kids generally. Now, I don't expect, I've had people ask me, does that mean we're going to be sending 7th and 8th graders to the, you know, career tech schools? I don't think that's what they're talking about. I think that's still going to be pretty much for high school. But I think that maybe they feel they need to do a little better PR with the opportunities that are available in some of these career tech schools. It's no longer students going to get trained to be an auto mechanic necessarily or a welder. Students are going to the career tech schools now for culinary arts, for computer tech, you know, for high technical things that they may go on from there to college even. Mm-hmm. I think I saw a statistic that about 60% of the kids go from there to college. But they're also better prepared to take a job right away. And so that's what the governor's talking about.
He mentioned, I think, $10 million in funding for some of this, which is, of course, chicken
feed.
Doesn't
sound like a lot, yeah.
Well, it is chicken feed. But there was a $66 million state program that's been out there using federal funds to help train people who are on welfare.
Yeah, this is different. This is out of the education side,
they
but we can
use,
talk about that.
Okay.
Job training in general is causing the governor some fits, I think, lately. And what we're talking about here is in the last budget, they set aside some federal welfare dollars for job training. And that job training has not really happened much. And so they're trying to beef that up and figure out why, so that they can make, again, these people who are unemployed and on welfare or food stamps or whatever, cash assistance, find jobs that they can do that aren't, you know, minimum wage job necessarily. I mean, that's maybe where they start, but helping them up the career ladder, getting them job training so they can take some jobs where they can actually support themselves and get off public assistance.
Right. And part of what's going on, too, it's not just in Ohio. A lot of governors will talk about, they call it the skills gap. And these are, you know, available positions that people can have to work, but they can't, the companies can't fill them because they lack qualified workers. Mm-hmm. So beyond even the high tech training that's needed, you know, there's more training needed for, you know, sort of the the vocational occupations we've always thought about, like welders and mechanics and whatnot. It kind of fell out of vogue where for a while the push was you got to get a college degree, you got to go to college, and sort of vocational education kind of took a back seat. Well, now with the skills gap, there's a recognition that, no, we really need to encourage people to go down that road and make sure we have workers in the pipeline who can fill these available jobs that are out there.
And destigmify it, too. I mean, by saying that just because you get a voc ed, you know, post-secondary voc ed training doesn't mean you can't go on and get that bachelor's.
Well, a good example right in our area is Honda in Marysville. Honda is facing a lot of retirements. They're looking at a lot of job openings, and they are now working with the Marysville school system and the Union County Chamber of Commerce on a school program to help train kids for those jobs at Honda and some of the other services that support Honda in that area. And those are good paying jobs, and those are jobs they're trying to push for local students to get ready for. So there's an effort. And you're seeing the same type of thing with in the fracking industry, although they don't like it, up in Carroll County, where they're trying to get students groomed for those jobs that are available, that are going to be available up in that area too. So I think they're just trying to, what the governor's interested in kind of overall is fine-tuning our job training so that we're targeting what we're doing to match with what the needs are here in the state. Mm-hmm. So they're trying to get a better read on what jobs are needed, what training is needed, and fine-tune the programs that they fund for
those
efforts.
It used to be that industry knew what it wanted, and when it hired people that they thought were intelligent and responsible and whatever other qualities they might be looking for in an employee, they trained them themselves.
That's right. They're not really willing to do that in a lot of cases anymore. Some companies will partner with community colleges to try to get people trained, you know, kind of like a some sort of skills certificate or something after high school. But looking for this kind of vocational training program, just in general, I'm not saying the seventh grade program is the answer, but these sorts of workforce development is kind of the buzzword, right? Programs are very high up on the list of what our businesses that are looking to maybe relocate to Ohio would look for in their site selection process, right? You know, Governor Kasich talks a lot about the tax structure as being, you know, wanting to recruit people to Ohio because of the tax structure. But this is a huge, huge factor. And another one is transportation infrastructure, things like that. So these are all things that Ohio, you know, needs to work on. Everyone in the country, frankly, needs to work on to try to bridge that gap.
That $66 million state program that didn't find very many jobs for people on welfare that you reported on in January, does that mean the $66 million wasn't spent?
Exactly.
And does that mean it goes back to the federal government?
No, these are federal TANF dollars that the state gets, so they can spend the money.
Okay.
I mean, the money will stay there. They can spend it. But the idea was to get people trained and back on their feet, and that's what's not happened.
We have an email from Shane regarding cigarette tax. He writes, in the long term, it seems that a cigarette tax increase being used to offset an income tax decrease isn't smart. The idea is to decrease smoking in Ohio, then the income from that tax will decrease over time, leaving a deficit from the income tax break. It seems that this proposal is short-sighted, or there is no real interest in decreasing smoking in Ohio, kind of the way the gas tax works. The idea being that that funds the construction of our roads and bridges, but as people drive more fuel-efficient cars, they drive less, that kind of thing. There's been less revenue from that. Let's turn quickly to something that you wrote about today, I think, Kathy, that Ohio is going to begin staggering distribution of food stamp benefits next month. The change comes at the request of grocers. Kathy Kandisky, how are food stamps currently being distributed and why the change?
Well, why the change is that I should say food stamps currently are distributed primarily on the first of the month. County welfare agencies have the option of distributing anywhere between the 1st and the 10th of the month, but most people get their food stamps on the 1st of the month. There's about 1.8 million Ohioans now on food stamps, so it's a pretty big pot of folks. And anybody that does their grocery shopping on the first of the month knows that there's tends to be more crowds at the store, not just food stamp recipients coming to do their grocery shopping, but
people
often
get paid on
the first of the month, or you know, Social Security benefits get paid on. There's all kinds of reasons. So the grocers have evidently been asking for years to have staggered issuance of food stamps, because what they face is issues with staffing. They have to staff up the first few days of the month. They have to build their inventory up a lot higher. They have to deal with crowds at the cash registers and such. So Ohio's not alone, but the Ohio Grocers Association has been pushing for this change. And I'm not really sure why it didn't happen sooner, because it doesn't seem particularly controversial, but the state officials tell me they were concerned about the transition period and how it affected the welfare or the food stamp recipient. If you're used to getting your food stamps on the first of the month and all of a sudden you have to wait till the 20th, you know, you're going to have almost a 3-week gap there, which could cause hardship for people. So what the state came up with was this. People who come on to the food stamp rolls are going to have their benefits issued anywhere between the 1st and the 20th of the month. People who are on the food stamp rolls now and stay on the food stamp rolls are not going to have the date of issuance changed for them. So that's how they're going to handle it.
So they're going to gradually
pretty
change.
Much. That's the idea. That's the idea. Now, some advocates for food stamp recipients are concerned that there could be a lot more impact than they're saying. And the reason is this. Food stamp recipients every so often have to resubmit verification of their income. And if that verification doesn't get turned in on time, or if, you know, there's some kind of lapse, then they would be considered a new beneficiary and they would get a new date. Now, of course, there's going to be people that argue, well, then I guess you need to get your income proof turned in on time. But still, that there could be some slippage there and there's some concern. But the idea is this, I mean, this clearly is to help the grocery industry and grocery stores serve their customers better, is what they say. We're not the first state to do it. Other states have done this as
well. It's funny because I've been noticing more lately when you go into the grocery store, sometimes it looks almost wiped out.
Yeah.
Is it just me?
Might be back to the slow inventory thing.
Mark, you don't grocery shop.
I help with grocery.
Mark is looking around.
So
the grocery store. Well,
all right. Then finally, in our last couple minutes, the Ohio Republican Party is getting picky about who it endorses and who it doesn't. It has withheld endorsements from 3 House members, including Ron Hood, who's been around as long as I have. He's been, I think, probably flip going back and forth between the House and the Senate or something. But what's going on there? Why is the Republican Party getting so stingy with its endorsements? Ron Hood's been a Republican probably since birth.
Right. And I haven't, as we've pointed out before, haven't been around in Columbus as long as the rest of you. But what I'm told by my sources is that these are concerns. It's Ron Hood, Ron Magg, who's from Lebanon down in Southwest Ohio, and then John Becker, who's from Claremont County in Southwest Ohio. These three Republicans, the caucus leaders, feel don't support general party unity across the board throughout the state. We're not talking necessarily votes in the House or things like that, but more political.
Okay.
A couple of examples I can bring up are, and again, someone else may need to talk a little bit more about Ron Hood because these other two guys I cover all the time. But Ron Magg. Supported someone who's running against Pete Beck, who has been indicted for 69 counts of fraud.
Okay.
So that's supporting someone who's running against an incumbent, even one who's been indicted.
Okay.
And the other, John Becker, has said that he'd be willing to perhaps support a viable candidate against John Kasich.
No knows.
Apparently.
For the Ohio Republican Party.
Gotta play nice.
Thank you so much for playing nice today. Chrissy Thompson, State Capitol reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer. Kathy Kandisky of the Columbus Dispatch. And Mark Niquette of the Bloomberg News. Thanks for joining us today. And thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.